So hello everyone and welcome to another OneLiner.com podcast. I am Craig and with me as always Scott.
Hello.
And Drew.
Hello.
It's been a while since we've spoken to you, but it's been a while since I've spoken to you. But these other two chaps have been ranting incessantly over the course of, I think, three catch-up podcasts recently, am I correct?
You are.
I am correct. There's a first. We've still got a couple of films that we'd like to catch up on, as well as a couple of recent and current releases. So without further ado, let us crack on. We're going to kick off this podcast, first of all, by catching up with a film which has been out of the cinema for a couple of weeks now. But Drew, tell us a little bit about The Equalizer.
Okie dokie. After seeing the results of a pimp's assault on a young prostitute, DIY superstore employee Robert McCall is compelled to make use of the skills learned in his mysterious former life to bring justice to his neighbourhood, actions which inadvertently put him on a collision course with the Russian mafia and their chief enforcer.
Oh no!
That'll happen. Loosely based on the 1980s TV series of the same name, Antoine Fuqua's The Equalizer contains much of what you'd expect from a vigilante tale, an incorruptible hero aiding those who are unable or unwilling to help themselves or turn to the police. The police here are, of course, corrupt, visceral action set pieces, a background of tragedy and violence. There's also a remarkable competency with household supplies and basic tools that make McCall seem like a one-man A-team. In most respects, Equalizer never rises above ordinary. The plot and dialogue are unremarkable, but competent. The action scenes well choreographed and entertaining, if too slowly paced and more than a little indulgent. At 2 hours 12 minutes, it's definitely overlong. There's also a resemblance in tone to 80s action movies, possibly a concession to the era of the TV show which inspired this, but this is inconsistent and rather detached from how the film begins. But in the end, it's all watchable enough, and certainly a step or two above Fuqua's last cinematic outing, the ludicrously overblown Olympus Has Fallen. The Equalizer's ace in the hole, though, and what makes it worth seeking out, though I still wouldn't recommend making strenuous efforts to do so, is Denzel Washington. As we've observed numerous times, Washington is one of those few actors who can elevate anything they're in simply due to their presence, and his quiet, calm authority and brooding intensity lift Equalizer from mediocrity to watchability. The final scene invites a sequel, and possibly even a series of films, but I'd hope that Washington could find something more befitting of his talents instead. Still, this is solid Saturday afternoon fare with an engaging central performance, and you could find worse things to watch.
And no doubt over the course of the next few weeks, we will. Just gutting that Edward Woodward's no longer around to make a cameo appearance, really, isn't it?
Edward Woodward.
You are, we are.
Even if he were just in a telephone box somewhere in the background, in an uncredited cameo. Ah, Edward. Moving swiftly on then to a film which has just exited the charts after quite a decent tenure, actually. I've heard a lot of people talking about it, but I've not had a chance to see it myself. Scott, what's the skinny on Gone Girl?
From the outset, it looks as though it may be something approaching a conventional drama, which you would probably not expect from David Fincher. You have Ben Affleck coming under suspicion of murder after his wife disappears, and there's a certain focus on a hostile media as they get the four-ring circus in to try and paint him as a violent, cheating, no good Nick. The twist in this tale, for once, is not limited to a final reel, though. Fairly early on, you find out that his wife, Amy Dunn, played by Rosamund Pike, is in fact not dead at all, and is merely faking her death and framing her cheating, no good husband. Framing in quite a dramatic style. And we uncover that Amy Dunn is indeed mental on an industrial scale, as we follow her ultimately failed attempt to keep a low profile in a trailer park, which prompts her to make a desperation call to an old flame who never quite gave up on her, Desi Collins, played by Neil Patrick Harris, which doesn't wind up working out quite the way she expected. Meanwhile, Nick, Ben Affleck's character, has uncovered this plot to frame him and is going on his own media offensive to try and regain the initiative by means of his slick PR, Tanner Bolt, played by Tyler Perry. And he's reaching out to the media and using those broadcasts to also relay messages to Amy. And the whole thing ties back together in a interesting fashion. There's a lot of nice twisty-turny stuff going on here, but it's not really the point of it to surprise you with these twists and turns. You'll probably see most of them coming once you get a kind of general grasp on what's going on after the first half hour. And what you're left with is a number of very good performances. It's delivers quite well in the drama. Tonally, it's perhaps not so successful. It kind of turns on a dime between being a fairly serious drama and then sort of falling into black comedy territory and then expecting you to take it as a serious drama again. It more or less gets away with these tonal shifts, but I can certainly see why it would annoy a lot of people. For me, it works pretty well, though. It's an engaging story all the way throughout. It's very interesting. If I did have a flaw to pick with it, it, in many ways, like life, does not tie itself up in a neat little bow. When you get to the end of the film, it doesn't really feel like the end of a film. It feels like the start of another film. But that's not generally a horrible thing. It is, however, a somewhat unsatisfying thing. I do sometimes get a bit annoyed when films just come up with a deus ex machina to wrap everything up into a nice neat little bow and then move on to the next story, and this doesn't happen here. It's more like life in that respect, but undeniably it's much less satisfying as an ending. That aside, though, the rest of it is alternately very well acted and occasionally very funny, as you'd probably expect from Fincher. Very well shot, wonderful use of cinematography. It's a very enjoyable film to watch. It's nowhere near Fincher's best, but even Fincher on a slightly off day is better than a hell of a lot of other people's work, especially lately. So I would certainly recommend anyone pick this up, try and give us a bash. It should be coming out in video fairly soon. I would definitely give it a chance to impress you. And once again, another great turn from Ben Affleck, the Renaissance man of this 2010s.
Recommended.
Yes. Come on, Linerbot recommends it.
That. You're saying about Ben Affleck there, apart from that one notable misstep in Geely, which I never actually saw, I never thought he'd give a particularly bad performance in most things he's been in the last 15 years.
Yeah, Daredevil was shit. That's probably over 15 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm not sure that was entirely his fault, though.
Yeah.
Well, Paycheck as well. Let's do our best to forget Paycheck.
Okay, that's a fair one. I had forgotten about that. Yeah. So thank you for bringing that back to my mind.
No, but I would broadly agree. And again, I know everybody talks about, and we'll get onto him later, Matthew McConaughey and the McConaissance, which I'm fed up of hearing now. But actually, not having witnessed the majority of that man's romantic comedy back catalogue, I've not seen him put in a bad performance ever. So I find it quite annoying when people talk about, a career renaissance or anything else in these terms. Affleck's all right with me, and I also wish people would get off his back about Batman.
Yeah, apparently given they haven't seen him as Batman yet.
Yes. Shall we give him a fair crack of the whip? So another film which has been knocking about on demand for a while, but it's probably worth picking up on, if not because we haven't found time to crowbar it in elsewhere, is Captain Phillips. Drew, give us a quick breakdown on that.
Yes, we remain as painfully current as ever. In 2009, the container ship Maersk Alabama was hijacked by Somali pirates and its captain, Richard Phillips, taken hostage. And it's that true story that's the basis for Paul Greengrass's Captain Phillips. Tom Hanks stars as a titular seaman, a competent leader whose attention to detail and procedure and the calm dissolution of tension amongst his crew may earn him the respect of his crew, but not necessarily the warmth and love. But when the ship is approached by pirate skiffs, Phillips' professionalism and cool head under fire gives the crew their best chance of survival. Now, let's just make this clear, though. There are no ass-kicking movie heroics on show here. Rather, the heroism is of the everyday, believable sort. An ordinary man thrown into extraordinary circumstances, finding the resolve and resources to tackle the obstacles thrown at him. There is a similar lack of sensationalism in the direction of cinematography. The handheld documentary style fits perfectly with and puts the audience right within the unfolding events, and Greengrass's direction maintains tension without ever feeling artificial or contrived. The deliberate pacing from the opening, with Phillips' measured response to the pirate threat and the observation of the well-drilled deployment of the ship's defences, gradually builds the tension, increasing further when the action moves to the claustrophobic confines of a lifeboat to finally be dispelled in a quiet but powerful final scene. Now, if I have a complaint, it's that while Phillips is given backstory, the pirates are less well served. Phillips is a working stiff who worries about the economy, who, with his wife, worries about the future for their children, their lack of opportunity and job security. They don't want to be partied, but realise that needs must. On the other hand, while there's an indication that a crime lord compels them to attack shipping, for the most part the Somalis are defined by their piracy. Fortunately, the players are not so constrained by this, and newcomer Barkhad Abdi is particularly impressive, going toe-to-toe with the likewise impressive Hanks throughout. Abdi plays Muse, who is the leader of the pirates aboard the Alabama, and his performance provides much of the depth the writing leaves out. Intelligent and dangerous, he nevertheless manages to generate sympathy for his situation. A clear-cut villain he is not. while of course it's impossible to know exactly how accurate this biopic is, it certainly feels authentic, which I suppose is all that matters. It's not entirely without flaws, but Captain Phillips is a quality thriller and well worth checking out. Would you concur, Mr. Eastman?
Broadly, yeah, I found it engaging enough. I don't think it's the best of Greengrass's work. I was a little bit baffled by the high praise heaped on it by the press in general, and I'm looking at its Metacritic score of 83 on IMDb, and all of the 100% positive reviews it's received from otherwise vaguely, well, the New York Post is in there, so let me put the brakes on that sentence. Yeah, otherwise reputable sources. Yeah, the sort of overwhelmingly positive thing, and yes, it's a well constructed, efficient thriller. I've never felt compelled to go back and watch it. I have watched it a couple of times, if only because having seen it initially, a family member has then wanted to watch it alongside me as well. But yeah, I mean, it's well constructed, it's well paced. Crucially, Greengrass is one of those directors who never feels compelled to rush himself. And as you point out, Drew, does a good job of sort of consistently and continuously ratcheting up tension along quite a well-defined curve, as opposed to just sort of jump-starting shock moments here and there. I felt it perhaps could have been slightly shorter. It could have done with 10, 15 minutes whacking off the runtime, but then you could probably say that about most films these days. And I found the conclusion a little bit underwhelming, but then it's kind of hard to know how you could have made a bigger deal of it really whilst maintaining the sort of constraints of the documentarian style and the very much true-to-life nature of the script.
I didn't find that underwhelming because I thought that the conclusion was more in the character rather than the action.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, as you point out, don't go in expecting massive thrills. I mean, the trailer throws about what appears to be moments of people like shooting rocket launchers and stuff off a ship, but what you soon find out turns out to be just people shooting a flare gun at some pirates to try and scare them off. So anyone sort of going in on the hope of sort of action on the high seas off the back of the trailer is going to be disappointed. But yeah, the climax, if not satisfying in a sort of action sense, very much so from a character point of view, is quite satisfying, and it should be applauded for that, actually, rather than me. I sound like I'm picking fault with it. The one thing that annoys me a bit about it, though, and you touched on the supporting actors there, Barkat Abdi in particular. He and his fellow pirates in the film were recruited from among untrained locals, non-actors local to some villages in Somalia, which is that thing that Hollywood does every now and again as the logical conclusion of The Method, which has, rather than Robert De Niro going and spending six weeks learning to be a pirate amongst these Somali guys, let's just get a Somali guy. And then they like to sort of slap themselves on the back about it, about how wonderful and humble a thing a Hollywood marketing machine can be, and they slap them up in front of an Oscar panel, quite negating the fact that all they've done is prove that pretty much anyone can do their job. So I don't think for one second Barkat Abdi should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor. I think that's absolutely fucking ludicrous. But that is my opinion. And I fully appreciate that opinions may differ on that. I thought, yes, it was interesting to do that in this instance. I don't think the performances were phenomenal. But then I would argue that Tom Hanks for a lot of the film isn't at his best either, and I've heard people say this is literally the best performance Tom Hanks has given. I don't agree with that. I think it's perhaps a performance from him that we haven't seen before, but I'm not sure it's his best. Having said that, I'm not sure what, completely off the cuff, I would pick as being a better example. So I don't know, perhaps this film just twisted my nips a little bit, and I don't know what it is. It's that thing where I just don't quite agree with all the praise that's been heaped on it, but perhaps it's just me. Perhaps it's just me. It is a solid and entertaining thriller. It's better than most other thrillers I have watched in the last couple of years, so I probably shouldn't be too down on it. It just didn't light up my life as I was quite expecting.
It's not clearly not the most fantastic thing ever. I just thought it was a very effective thriller. I really liked the Somali guys, actually. There was a, particularly Abdi, there was a kind of nervous energy to him.
Oh, there certainly is.
Which makes the character very, very compelling. And there's something about the way Greengrass builds, and he's very deliberate. And at the start, too, when they're focusing on the ship's defences and things, and you think, that could and possibly even should be really dull, but actually...
Yeah, some guys on a little skiff trying to get a stepladder up the side of a boat.
Yeah, and they're preparing hoses and things, and it's absolutely captivating.
Yeah.
This true story thriller, something Greengrass has actually tackled before in United 93, and it's vastly more successful than that. So whether perhaps he's learned from that
experience. No fan of that film, were I. I think, do you know what the problem is for it for me, is that Yeah, I do think those guys bring an energy to it, but at no point do I look at those guys and go, oh yeah, they must be actors. It's patently obvious that they're not trained actors. And all that did for me actually was create this divide between them and the rest of the guys, which in some circumstances might be a desirable thing, but actually I just thought it was rather jarring. Again, I don't know. Maybe I've gone in, maybe I've prejudged it. I don't know. But there you go. Yeah, I do. But it is absolutely one of the better thrillers that I've seen recently, so I can't complain about it. And on that, Drew, I believe you're going to tell us a little bit about The Judge.
I will, Craig, I will.
Excellent.
Robert Downey Jr. plays a cynical and possibly unscrupulous big-time Chicago lawyer called Hank Palmer. The Judge is a family relationship come legal drama that sees Hank return to his hometown to attend his mother's funeral. While he's there, he becomes embroiled in an unexpected court case in that he must defend his father, who is the judge of the title, from a murder charge. Now, despite being about a judge and his lawyer son, for the most part, the legal case at the centre of the film is not much more than a MacGuffin, as Hank explores his relationship with his brothers, his daughter, and most importantly, his father. As Hank is a stereotypical big city lawyer, he must also rediscover his sense of justice and, most importantly, his soul, which being a stereotypical big city lawyer, he doesn't have anymore. And now this is something which towering cinematic achievements like Doc Hollywood have taught us. Small thing, Mary.
Sorry, I wasn't expecting that.
Yes, because films like Doc Hollywood have taught us that small town America is ideally suited for the reclamation of one's soul. So by spending time with his family in the picturesque Indiana town and rekindling old flames, Hank becomes a better man. Yada yada yada. Now, if you're thinking this all sounds rather prosaic and cliched, then you'd be absolutely right, because it is rather prosaic and cliched. What makes The Judge worth considering are the leads. Downey Jr.'s Hank is countered by Robert Duvall as his father, and both rise above the rather mundane nature of the script. Robert Downey Jr. is as charismatic as ever, and is given some opportunity to display his dramatic as well as his comedic chops, while Duvall isn't stretched here, because, let's be fair, opinionated, cantankerous old man is a pretty well-worn groove for him. His and Downey's scenes are compelling, even if both are deserving of far richer dialogue. It's a strange film that has a cast far better than the work deserves. And perhaps in stronger directorial hands, it'd be a more compelling film. This is directed by the director responsible for Fred Claus, which is a rather damning statement. But yeah, certainly the two leads together. There's some support from Vincent D'Onofrio, who's quite appealing in this, and actually an underused but still compelling Billy Bob Thornton as the prosecuting attorney. It's something that will probably leave you wishing that there was more substance here, but there's enough enjoyment in the two leads to make it worth checking out. Although, again, like I said earlier with The Equalizer, I wouldn't make strenuous efforts to do so.
There you go. Scott, what would you add to that?
I can't really add a lot to it. I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you were saying it's one of these bizarre instances of where a film just somehow manages to get a cast attached to it that is well above the level of the work that they've actually got in front of it. It's a script that in no way deserves to have Robert Downey Jr. and Robert Duvall and Billy Bob Thornton and Vincent D'Onofrio in it. They're all acting well above the level of the script.
Mm-hmm.
And that does make it quite watchable, but it's only ever a very short step away from being a made-for-television movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it does scream Hallmark.
Yes.
But yes, it's the cast. The cast elevates it. You just imagine the same cast with a better script and how amazing a film that could have been.
Yes, and it's equally easy to imagine the same script with a worse cast.
And say,
Judge Reinhold
disaster.
Or something,
yes.
And it'd be an absolute horror show.
Judge Reinhold. Judge Reinhold is the judge.
Judge Reinhold is Doc Hollywood in The Judge.
The most confusing film you'll see all year.
In The Judge, colon, The Doc.
I've now picturing this horrible amalgam of about 20 different films in which the judge here is played by Judge Reinhold and Fred Savage is his son.
You've already made a better film.
It's fine. I enjoyed it well enough to watch it. It's worth, I'd say, probably even still worth taking a look at if you're a fan of the cast, such as Duvall and Downey Jr., and if you're not, then why aren't you?
Yeah, that's the thing. Both of those actors are basically endlessly watchable.
Yeah.
They both exude charisma. They're both, even here with a lesser script, they've got ability coming out of every possible orifice because it's just overflowing so much.
It's a disgusting, disgusting film.
I want to see that on the poster. Ability coming out of every orifice.
several degrees better than most taglines. It's all right. It's worth checking just if you like the cast. If you don't like the cast, then yes, as Scott said, what's wrong with you? Why don't you?
There you go. Moving swiftly on to one of the great Philip Seymour Hoffman's final performances, A Most Wanted Man, Scott, take it away.
Based on a Jean Le Carré novel, so you can probably get the gist of what it's going to be about just from that alone, directed by Antoine Corbijn? Corbijn? I can't remember how to pronounce his.
Corbijn, I think.
Corbijn. Kurt Cobain, directed by Kurt Cobain.
Directed by Corbin Dallas.
Corbin Dallas was exactly what was in my head there.
With Super Green.
The bulk of the film follows old Philip as Gunter Bachmann, a German intelligence agent running a... Of course, it's one of these films where you need to get a German, so what better to do than figure an American?
Yes, it took place during the great German actor strike of 2013.
Thankfully, there are at least a couple of German actors along with him, including Daniel Brühl, who... I'm a big fan of. He's running a very small counterintelligence agency tracking Muslim extremists, and he's also trying to get a hold of a financial supply that's going to the Al-Qaeda network under a front that he suspects but can't prove anything from. This thread clashes with another when a young Chechen Muslim immigrant illegally shows up on the German shores and starts getting involved in claiming his father's legacy as some money that's been left to him through a variety of slightly dodgy bank executives, and this all kind of ties back into the finance angle. It is somewhat more exciting than that might sound on a recap. It's not basically an Excel simulator. This does have...
It's not about PPI claims and that.
Yes.
Featuring Willem Dafoe as Clippy.
It works very well. It's more along the lines of the low-key Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy kind of line of spy films rather than your James Bond things. It's somewhat low-key. It's very more police investigative work that's going on here rather than anything else, but it works particularly well, largely because you've got Philip Seymour Hoffman in the leading role and he's endlessly watchable and provides a compelling central performance that actually feels like it could well be what actually happens in counterintelligence operations rather than your usual... kind of nonsense that you would get.
There's a down-to-earth authenticity to it, isn't there?
Yes. There's no real fireworks involved. There's not too many dramatic set pieces throughout most of it. It has a very, as you say, kind of down-to-earth, realistic feel to a lot of it, which does make the ending all the more shocking when it comes sort of almost out of nowhere with a very sort of a sudden crashing ending to the piece, which works very well and kind of does a good job of illustrating the kind of how we're in the mess that we're in with these kind of operations. I thought this was a really great film. It's certainly the best spy film I've seen since Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Yep. It may even, I think, be a little better than it, which is probably not the prevailing opinion, but I thought it was really good. I don't know if I could back that up with paperwork. I suspect if I watched it again, there's so many good performances in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy that it would outclass this in the long run, but certainly it gives it a run for its money, I would say. So I can't give it any more of a recommendation than that.
It's on my watch list. It seems right up my alley of that sort of slow procedural kind of thing. Drew, what was your take on it?
It's largely the same as Scott's. I didn't like it quite so much. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, certainly better. But as Scott said, there's a lot of similarities about the deliberate pacing, the low-key nature of it. It's very appealing. Perhaps why I wouldn't put it on the same sort of level as Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy is that as good as the actors are, they're not German and they're somewhat hamstrung by being Americans with German accents, the three notable people being Philip Seymour Hoffman, Willem Dafoe and Rachel McAdams. A bigger role for Daniel Brühl, for instance, instead might have been preferable, but
yeah.
I don't have too much to add to what Scott said, so it's very good. Quality writing, quality performances, it just, again, makes you sad that Philip Seymour Hoffman did such daft things to himself.
The Nightcrawler, another film which has piqued some interest. Drew, what be that about?
Filled with energy, ambition and a vast repertoire of business-speak douchebaggery that would see him very much at home as a contestant on The Apprentice, petty thief Lou Bloom is always on the lookout for the thing that will elevate him into the corporate world where he believes his true destiny lies. He finds his entry point and his calling when one night he comes across a messy car crash and sees a freelance video news crew arrive and shoot the scene, footage which he later sees in the morning news. Seeing the potential for success, Bloom acquires a police scanner and a camcorder and begins building his empire, not allowing those little things like other people, the law, or scruples get in his way. If Bloom ever had scruples, he probably exchanged them for a sandwich years before the film begins. Writer-director Dan Gilroy's satire of crime-led news as entertainment culture may be neither novel nor subtle, but it is powerfully delivered and rings unpleasantly and uncomfortably true. Observations about rich white people being attacked by poorer non-whites as ratings winners are painfully on the nose, and the manipulation, career advancement agendas, and shooting down of moral objections in deference to audience share never feel exaggerated. All of this is set against director of photography Robert Elswit's moody, streetlight and neon sign-lit Los Angeles, a slick and glossy backdrop which is as compelling and integral as the LA scene in the likes of Collateral and Drive. And the stronger supporting player here is the performances from Renee Russo, her best in the last 15 years, and Four Lions Riz Ahmed. But this is Gyllenhaal's film. In lesser hands, Bloom could be unintentionally comedic. His business feat could easily make him sound ludicrous and dismissible, but there's a steeliness in his eye and a tense energy in his delivery that means that Bloom is captivating and dangerous. Nightcrawler is excellent, and Gyllenhaal's portrayal of the amoral anti-hero ought to be held in the same regard as De Niro's Travis Bickle. It's that good.
Nice. High praise indeed.
There are other flaws with the film in general. It's not novel, and the satire isn't in any way subversive, and it's very, very on the nose, but Gyllenhaal is incredible in it. And Lou Bloom really ought to become a very, very memorable character. He's an odious human being, and yet you can't stop watching him.
I'd like to buy that man a pint. Interstellar, then, one of the year's biggest films. Scott, give us a quick plot synopsis.
Not too distant future. You have an Earth that is, for want of a better term, fucked.
That is a technical term.
It seems to be what NASA comes up with. It's like, yeah, this planet's fucked. Can't grow anything. The soil's starting to fuck up. It's all fucked, man. Crops are failing. There's hinted at it was a kind of more major crash that happened earlier. There's been a major population crash. The people that are left are still kind of scrabbling around, just basically trying desperately to get enough food to feed the population. And it's clear that through a combination of, well, it's never referred to as global warming, but clearly it's going to be something like that, and a mysterious blight, which I think is the replacement for global warming in a way to try and stop scaring the conservatives away from it.
It's like suddenly Falkirk was used as a template for the rest of the world.
It's all just fucked. So it becomes clear that there is no chance that we're going to survive on this Earth unless something serious changes. As part of that, you have a trained military pilot, Cooper, played by Matthew McConaughey, is now reduced to farming and looking after the combine harvesters and such like. However, a mysterious message leads him to a hidden NASA encampment where he discovers that, as always, the saviour of humanity, Michael Caine, Professor Brand, is trying to come up with a last-ditch solution, either sending off a series of DNA samples to start a colony from scratch on a distant planet, or perhaps also to come up with a new propulsion system to start kicking out proper colonization spaceships, try and get people off Earth and out into the wide black yonder. As part of this, they discover that one possible solution to this is a wormhole has opened up just somewhere outside Saturn, I think it was. And
just next to the Walmart.
Just next to the Spar. They've previously sent through some explorers and they've never got some data back. They reckon there's a few good planets that they could possibly use as their colonies on the other side. So it's up to Cooper to take a crew over to the other side of the wormhole, see what's going on, come out with a base for humanity and then report back. But it doesn't quite go to plan as things soon go to shit. There's some time dilation going on, which means that he ages about 40 years in the space of 3 hours for basically plot convenience terms, and then it all gets somewhat more messy from there. Up to about halfway through the film, it's based more or less on what you could forgive for being proper science. At about the halfway point, basically as soon as they cross that wormhole, everything goes into wah-wah, pulled out of the ass territory, and it becomes much worse for it, in my opinion. It's really a film that did not connect with me in the slightest. It's technically very well put together, as you would expect from Christopher Nolan, but it just felt awfully sterile. There's not a lot of, well, there are moments where there's bits of human drama in there, but it felt like they were just slapped on almost in the point where it's like, okay, I feel that there's probably going to be a dip in people's engagement at this point, let's slap some random drama into it. And then random drama occurred, and there's an evil doctor, and there's some science that doesn't make sense to force another little bit of drama and
an evil
random
doctor.
Waves and stuff.
An evil doctor because it is lost in space.
Yeah, so it felt a bit manipulative in that respect to me. Sure, stuff is a decent performance from McConaughey, but you know, I didn't feel it was all that spectacular. It just didn't really engage with me on a lot of levels. I don't really see what the hype is about. I'll probably kick it back over to Drew or Craig at this point, because I think you probably like it a bit better than I did, so I don't want to be a Debbie Downer on the whole thing.
No, not at all. Drew, what would you...
I can disagree with a lot of what Scott said, except I enjoyed it an awful lot more.
Mm.
There's certainly, it's guilty of dropping drama bombs, which never seemed necessary. There was more than enough drama just going on with the fact that Earth was dying and these people needed to find a new Earth or a new place for humans to live.
It seems like enough peril to be getting on with, right?
Exactly, yes. So anything else seemed extraneous. There was certainly also the fact that you've got Matthew McConaughey, who is a former test pilot, so therefore a former member of the military, understands the importance of the mission, should have been picked because he was able to do it and also understood the chain of command, etc. And largely
ends up doing it because he accidentally stumbles upon their secret base.
Yeah, because there's some dust in a room.
Less than that, and let's just ignore the ending, which is where it entirely lost me.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew McConaughey is this former military person who would understand the chain of command, understand the importance of the mission, and who decides to drop all pretense of professionalism in space and go, wow, my family. It's like, how about the entire population of the human species, but no, my family? That kind of annoyed me, rubbed me the wrong way. Otherwise, I enjoyed it, other than the fact that the drama bombs just, they seemed extraneous. As you say, it didn't need any more. There was plenty of peril to be getting on with.
Mm. I think the problem with it from, I should say up front, I did really enjoy it. I think it's perilously close in places to being a masterpiece in terms of Nolan's output. It doesn't quite make it. It ends up being probably not as good as something like Inception, although I feel it had potential to be so. From a drama, from an emotional perspective, I think people have complained about Christopher Nolan not being that emotionally engaging in his films. And I don't think that's necessarily a fair comment, but I can understand where people are coming from with that. I feel in this instance, for me, the emotional stuff, he kind of works as though they're action set pieces, in that he sort of builds to, or doesn't so much build to, just sort of drops these emotional climaxes on you every now and again, as though it's to sort of keep things happening. There's nothing here happening action-wise, so I'm going to hit you with this emotional thing. And he perhaps doesn't build that as subtly as he might. But I did really enjoy it. I think where I think, obviously, I don't know, Scott, if you're talking about the sort of the physics aspect of it, the science aspect of it not being particularly stringent. But then I don't feel like Nolan's the kind of guy who sets out to make a hard sci-fi film. Probably the closest thing Nolan's done to hard sci-fi is probably more something along the lines of The Prestige. The latter half of that film probably errs more towards hard sci-fi than even something like Interstellar does.
I'm pretty sure that Interstellar is closer to hard science fiction than The Prestige.
What, with its cloning machines?
Yes, I don't think you'll find too many people to back up your side of the
argument. No, but I think...
Think about it is that it was marketed very much as though, maybe not it's going to be the higher to science fiction, but there's nothing in the trailers that says it's going to be a ridiculous fantasy. And that's what it winds up being at the end. It's the same reason I didn't like Looper, is when it all got up to the end and it just wound up being magic. And it starts relatively early on. I mean, when you think about the reasons they went to the planet of the plot devices to get them older, it was... The reason he gave was like, oh, well, it was just rebroadcasting the same bit of data over and over again. So, right, in these measurements that you're taking of the planet, at no point does it include a date stamp where you could have told that. Because I don't believe that for a second, and that's the only reason you've had people go to that planet, to make the rest of the film have any sort of sense to it.
Yeah.
So I could kind of forgive that, but it just that's like where it starts getting stupid, and it just goes downhill from there. And I was sold something that was going to be a relatively mature bit of science fiction, and what I got was nonsense. And I don't necessarily mind nonsense, but it was just quite manipulative nonsense at the end of the day. And I didn't feel that I connected with any of the characters. You know what, I wouldn't, you know, if it was just like a junk science fiction thing, I wouldn't have minded it so much if it had like great performances, compelling actors. But the only thing that I liked in this was the visual aspects of it, which are undeniably fantastic. But the rest of it was just there, and it didn't really do anything for me at all. I mean, there's some really lovely bits, like the planet of the evil doctor with the Arctic stuff. That looked great. There's some decent action set pieces on it, but not a lot of them make any sense that they would have happened in the first instance. And I just can't get away from the fact that it doesn't really make a great deal of sense at all.
But listen, say what you mean.
What I'm saying is that this film should have starred Judge Reinhold.
No, I don't agree that this was being sold as like a hard sci-fi film, and I don't think Nolan would be capable of doing hard sci-fi if he tried. I think this is a new Scientist magazine of sci-fi films. He's trying to take some pretty big concepts, like you say, like time dilation and frame dragging, and make them accessible to a multiplex audience, which is probably commendable, I think. However, I don't think in the end what he does is service either market fully. That, like you say, anyone who's got a broad or more focused interest in any of the physics or cosmology of the film will instantly pick out flaws that, as you say, are quite cloyingly difficult to overlook and forgive, whereas it's probably too focused on that stuff for a general audience, and I don't think the emotional stuff has got the impetus it needs to serve the drama aspect of it. But I still think overall I enjoyed the film greatly. I think it's worth saying that I think I pointed this out. I can't remember if I mentioned it to you, Drew, or if it was a tweet I made, but I probably would have watched this film much differently a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Fatherhood. Yes, before I had a daughter. And in the end, actually, there were a couple of moments of film where I did empathise with the central character quite a bit on a number of occasions, to the point where there was one line towards the end of the film that almost had me crumple in my seat that I wasn't expecting. I got quite blindsided by it. But I can kind of see where, my own circumstance aside, if I were able to remove myself from that, like some quantum phantom outside the window of a shuttle, I would probably tend to agree with you on a few more of the points. But I think there's a lot to enjoy about it. I think it's a brave failure that could have been an epic success with the right tweaks here and there. I also think it's worth pointing out some of the best robot design. Back me up here. I think he played a blinder with the robot design on those guys, which at first I thought were the crappest robot designs I'd ever seen, up until the point where one of them, in a moment of jeopardy, suddenly springs into life and you realise that they're actually quite phenomenally well designed. That's a small point to be heaping praise on a film of this scale. Yeah, I don't think anyone would agree that it's Nolan's best work, but I want to like it a lot. Say I enjoyed it a lot more than I did, but as it is, I just really enjoyed it. I don't think it outstayed its welcome.
No, I think I come somewhere in between the two of you here and how much I enjoyed it. Now, I'm not sure quite what it was sold as, but it certainly started off as being something fairly grounded in science by movie standards anyway. And I was really, really enjoying that. I thought it was probably some of the best like proper sci-fi since Source Code, possibly. And I was thoroughly enjoying that, and then it just got daft or batshit mental, to put it another way, with fifth dimensions and utter nonsense. I mean,
it had a few too many aspirations towards the 2001 end of the scale, I think.
Yes, but a film I've never cared for anyway. Some of the other bits sort of brought back things like Contact, but again, I mean, it started off being fairly, well, reasonably scientific, and I was enjoying that. And then it just, with the character sort of abandoning all of his military training and stuff and just going, oh, I'm a family, and I can understand why, but it was just a bit annoying that it just so readily got rid of that, that he had no professionalism at all. And then by the ending, it lost me. Yeah, I was enjoying it up to that point. It's certainly interesting. It's not like most other stuff out there, so it's got that in its favour. I don't think it helped much that it had Hans Zimmer's score came as his sort of interpretation of Philip Glass.
Because I didn't mind the score.
That was an oral assault, as far as I was concerned.
Oh, I didn't mind it at all. I think the things, though, that are, like I say, the more sort of cheap emotional moments, like Drew, you called out a particular planetary visit that should never have happened in the first place. They said if they'd bothered with a date stamp. And that whole section of the film seems to be set up purely for this
emotional time loop thing they've got going on.
Yeah, this emotional punch in the gut moment when they return to the dropship, as it were, that they came back from. And there's quite an unexpected moment there where, well, you can't really say much about it without plot spoilers, but there is a character who's been waiting for them, and there's a moment there which does sort of come as a sort of... There were audible gasps in the cinema when at the screening we were at. I'm not quite sure... obviously it worked, but I'm not quite sure that Nolan earned that.
I can see what Scott's saying to about it being sterile and that he's saying he didn't care for the characters, and I didn't feel that, but I can see why you would. But then he said it's relying too much on your attachment to the characters at the end and hoping that you won't think too closely about it, like Jessica Chastain's scenes towards the end.
To be fair, most of the visual aspects of it were pretty stunning. And much as I'm wailing on this, it's only because I hold Nolan to such high standards.
Mm.
This is still better than like 96% of all the films I've seen this year.
I get the impression that you're like quite raw about it, but I mean, did you not enjoy it at all, or are you just venting a bit at Nolan here and you did actually enjoy it as a film?
If I'd left about the halfway point, I would have become really enjoying it. It's very much tarnished by its second and third acts, really. It's fine, but it's still better than a number of films I've seen this year, but it certainly isn't grazing my top 10, even having seen a very reduced number of films this year. But it's by no means bad, but it doesn't really rise much above... Well, no, that's not fair. Aspects of it really do rise above mediocre to being very, 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 very good. But the bits that I find objectionable kind of drag it all back down. So it's definitely worth seeing for the highs, but I find the lows always... always present.
It's certainly worth seeing because it's very well made. I think that's undeniable. I have issues with the character motivations and with some of the mystical aspects of it. I find it pretty entertaining. It's worth watching. I didn't feel as angry or disappointed by this even when it went a bit mad as I was with Looper.
Yeah, for some reason I felt a lot more forgiven about this. I think I just can't detach myself from the fact I've now got a little sprog who I have to promise not to travel across the galaxy away from.
And you're worried you might not be able to keep that promise, and well, that's what's giving it.
There was a point earlier tonight where I got a couple of hundred mils of milk sicked back up over me that absolutely drenched my top, where I was thinking about finding a rocket or building one. But no.
I suppose another film that's kind of tried to base itself on people getting back to their family, whether or not they still existed, and purported to be based on real science was Gravity from last year, and it's vastly more successful than Gravity.
Oh, yeah.
And it's worth watching. I mean, any sort of really big budget thing that tries something so grand is to be admired, applauded, and watched. How successful it is, obviously, that's up for debate, but again, I just like that films like this exist, that they're not just your normal dumb blockbuster.
It's actually massively also, like you say, not just in the fact that it's sci-fi and it's McConaughey, but it also shares an awful lot thematically with Contact, in that they're both essentially not sci-fi films at all. They're both films about a father-daughter relationship, mm-hmm. for the most part.
Yeah. I believe they're based on by the same scientist advisor fellas' theories. So
Kip Thorne.
That's where it's coming from, I think.
Yeah.
I feel, curiously enough, you mentioned 2001 earlier, and I feel pretty much the same about this as I do about 2001.
Mm.
I like it to the point where it goes mental, yes. At which point I rapidly check out.
Yeah.
So, I basically don't like any of 2001 at all, so Interstellar's definitely ahead for me there.
Mm. No, I mean, I like 2001 as much as the next man, assuming the next man is Scott, essentially, yeah. I do find it enjoyable. I do find it enjoyable up until the point at which, yeah, once Hal's been unplugged, yeah. And it all goes a little bit batshit and sort of...
oh my God, how are we going to end this? Tunnels, space baby, there we go.
Yeah, let's do that LSD effect at the screen.
A problem with Contact also has, where the ending is definitely a very unsatisfying portion of that film.
It's certainly, it's the weakest part. It's the weakest part. No, Interstellar, interesting. It's had very mixed reviews. So,
and here's another one.
Yeah, here's one where three people occupy very different areas of ground. So I think that just about cuts it for this podcast. Was there anything else we wanted to express?
Upstream Colour's totally shit.
Yeah, that's it. We considered covering this, but Scott and I, who both saw it, couldn't come up with more than it was baffling shite. So there's your review.
Okay, and I would add that Zero Theorem is baffling, if not necessarily shite, but does feature a lovely French woman, which isn't something you'll hear me say often. And on that xenophobic note, Sophie Marceau, there you go, Sophie Marceau and the young lady in this, which I can't remember her name, terrible.
Melanie Thierry.
Yes, there you are. So, yes, don't forget that you can always drop us a line, podcast@theoneliner.com. You can find us on Twitter @theoneliner, and you'll also find our individual accounts there as well. So I guess until next we speak, thank you very much for putting up with us for another hour or whatever. I was Craig, Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was invariably a Drew.
Farewell.
Catch you on the flip side. Drew Tavendale, said the judge, had ability coming out of every orifice.